Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 28th of January. I've been far away for the past week, so I'd like to thank Veronica Rickert for filling in for me. And we are going to do all things political for the next hour, and there's a great deal to talk about. Craig Gilbert is our guest, always knows what's going on many fronts, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Since last we spoke, the president gave his second inaugural address, in which some have said he gave a progressive view of government. We'll talk a bit about that. Immigration reform very much on the agenda today and tomorrow. President giving a speech tomorrow, and there are four Democrats and four Republicans who are going to be announcing a bipartisan plan for immigration reform today. We will talk about gun legislation and whether or not there will be anything and how that debate is progressing. We will talk about whether or not the president needs to really get moving on whatever he wants to accomplish pretty darn soon, because 18 months from now, all everybody will be talking about is the next election. So those are a few things on the agenda this morning. Here is our phone number for you to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave a message for us on our Facebook page, and that address is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Oh, we also have to talk about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's talk before Congress on Benghazi. We have a lot to talk about today. Hello, Craig. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, there is a lot to talk about. It was a busy week last week, and it's going to be busy the next few months.
It sure is. What about this idea that the president has to get passed, if he can get it passed, whatever he wants done pretty darn soon because elections are around the corner?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true to a large extent. You wonder how much that, I mean, that's been the traditional thinking. And, you know, we're kind of locked in now, though, to this period of divided government where Republicans really seem to have a strong foothold in the House of Representatives, partly because of the way the districts are drawn. So it's, you know, whatever happens in the next, you know, in the next 2 years, there's a pretty good chance we're looking at the same divided government in the second half of President Obama's second term. It's always true that the closer you get to a presidential election, the harder it is to get stuff done. So I think they're focused on trying to make some things happen in these next 2 years. But you're going to have the same obstacles throughout his second term that we have right now and that we've had in the recent past, which is just you know, two parties that are fundamentally divided on a lot of big issues.
Right. Well, let's start out with today and tomorrow. This bipartisan group of legislators is going to be announcing an immigration reform plan today. Tomorrow, it's President Obama. Why is it in that order? What are these senators doing announcing all of this today?
I think this key senators want to take the lead on this, and they've basically appealed to the White House to let them take the lead on this. And the White House, you know, may be okay with that. You know, that certainly has happened in the past. It happened with health care legislation, which people thought was maybe a mixed blessing in that regard. But on immigration, you know, it may make sense. I mean, it's really going to be up to both chambers to really legislate on this issue. They're going to have to find the sweet spot where they can get majorities in both houses, and, you know, there's a feeling or a growing feeling that it's at least in the realm of possibility that that can happen because of the shifting politics on this issue.
Mm-hmm. And do both plans, would all plans include a pathway to citizenship, Craig?
Well, in theory, yes, or on paper, yes, but, you know, we really don't know what that means. I mean, it can mean a lot of different things. Marco Rubio has talked about a pathway for the undocumented. You know, how many people does that apply to? And I think on the Republican side, you know, they're not talking about a pathway to citizenship for the majority or most or all of the undocumented. They're talking about you know, a temporary work permits for some people, maybe a, you know, legal status for others. But I think they want to reserve a pathway to citizenship for a smaller group and a smaller set of circumstances. And they also, in order to satisfy people in their party who have talked about amnesty and talked about rewarding illegal immigration, they want to try to construct it in a way that you sort of have to go to the back of the line to get citizenship. But they've sort of crossed one Rubicon, at least some Republicans have, which is this notion that there has to be some, or there should be some hope for illegal immigrants of achieving legal status and citizenship in this country, so that they're not, we don't have a permanent class of non-citizens living here. And so I think they've moved the ball a little bit, mm-hmm. and it just remains to be seen how in detail this actually gets worked out.
And do the Republicans need to take on this issue and do so in a bipartisan fashion, simply because they're going to need to be able to figure out some plan to get Latino voters voting for them again?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, a lot of the impetus here. Now, mm-hmm. I think it's sort of understood by people in both parties that it's not necessarily enough for Republicans, to get behind some sort of comprehensive immigration plan. I think it's a lot of, strategists in the Republican Party understand it's also going to be very important, how they talk about this issue and the rhetorical signals they send and the tone and, also how their future presidential nominees approach the issue. So I don't think anybody thinks it's a magic bullet that passing a comprehensive immigration law is going to solve the party's problems with Latino voters overnight. But I think they want to start taking some steps in that direction, because it's just hugely alarming to people in the party, the demographics, the political demographics on this.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of bullets, before I was out of the country for the last week, and before I left, there was a great deal of conversation about what kind of legislation we may pass concerning guns. Where are we now on that issue? From what I've been reading over the weekend, it sounds as though everybody's kind of drawing back a little bit on any kind of substantial change. Do you think that's the case, or will there be some kind of change?
I think that's the case. I'm skeptical about the idea of a big change. And I don't even know about the small changes. I mean, this is one of those issues where it's less clear to me that the politics has changed on guns compared to, for example, the issue of immigration. If you look at the polling, I mean, the big question everybody's asking themselves is, how much changed with Newtown, Connecticut?
Right.
And clearly something changed, and it did move the numbers in the polls, and it was, I think you can certainly say, it was a different, it's had a different impact than some of the other shootings we've seen, which have also generated a lot of debate and discussion about the gun laws, but how much impact, it's really unclear. And if you look at some of the polling, Pew has asked for years this question about, basically asking voters to say which is more important, protecting gun rights or controlling gun ownership. And even though it bumped the numbers after Newtown, the percentage of people who said controlling gun ownership is more important went up into a bare majority, it's still well below the levels it was in the 90s and during the George W. Bush presidency. So I think you have to be cautious about the impact of Newtown, the political impact. Whenever you have, I mean, the one thing that's changed over time, I think, is that on the gun side, on the gun rights side, people are much more, whether it's a majority or a minority of the country, that side is much more cohesive and much more organized than it was 20 or 30 years ago, and it just makes it hard to change the gun laws.
Mm-hmm. I know Dianne Feinstein is leading the charge on this. When will legislation, has she introduced legislation yet? Will it be debated, or is it yet to be introduced?
Yeah, I don't know when, if we have a timetable for that or not.
I see.
And again, there are some things that, when you look at the specific proposals out there, there are some things that poll well. I mean, the idea of expanding background checks polls well. The idea of outlawing some of these big clips that hold 30 rounds or 15 rounds or whatever, some of that stuff polls well. But again, whether that means that, we get legislation to do, you know, the items that poll the best, or whether it's more limited than that. It's really an open question.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed there were a number of stories about various states, probably, well, they were Republican states, a lot of attention focused on Louisiana, but also here in Wisconsin, where there's been substantial talk about changing taxing, and the taxes would come more from sales tax, lowering property taxes, lowering corporate taxes. There seems to be a move afoot to do just that in mostly Republican states.
Yeah, I mean, we're in this era where, we've talked about this in the past, where Democrats have been winning at the presidential level, and obviously they occupy the White House and control the Senate, but Republicans have had a lot of success at the state level, and because of the 2010 elections, they're in position to do dramatic things in terms of policies. And so they did some dramatic things in the last 2 years, and now the next wave of legislation, of Republican legislation at the state level, could be on taxation. And this is one idea that's very popular on the Republican side, but it's also kind of volatile. It's playing with dynamite a little bit, because when you start talking about shifting away from what's typically a progressive income tax to flat rates and to a sales tax, then you know, you're sort of open to the accusation that you're shifting the tax burden in a very regressive way. And so there's sort of a economic argument for consumption taxes, but I think some Republicans are also trying to consider the political impact and how to do it in a way that doesn't make them vulnerable to the charge that they're shifting the tax burden from wealthier people to poorer people.
Let's talk about the president's inaugural address. Was it a progressive agenda?
Yeah. I mean, I think both in a general way and in a specific way. I mean, inaugural addresses are sometimes very airy and kind of vague and lyrical. And this was, while it wasn't a State of the Union speech, it was quite concrete and specific in terms of certain, you know, in terms of the issues, you know, gay rights, climate change, voting laws. I mean, there was a litany of issues that are important to people on the left and to Democrats that he mentioned and gave prominence to in there. And it was sort of taken as a signal that this is a president who's going to try to move an agenda, a progressive agenda, in his second term, and whether or not Republicans like it.
We're going to go to phone calls in just a moment. Craig Gilbert is our guest for All Things Political this Monday. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've already covered a lot of territory, but we've only just begun, so we'll cover more momentarily. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Immigration reform, very much what will be discussed today and tomorrow in Nevada, and also a bipartisan group of senators will be announcing a plan today for immigration reform. We haven't had a chance to talk about the president's address last week because I wasn't here, and we're still thinking about that, the areas that he wanted to pay attention to. What about what will happen with gun legislation? What about global warming? We're going to talk a lot about that the second hour of our program today, but he did mention that in the address, and many people were pleased that he did just that. So feel free to join the conversation, won't you? We haven't talked for a while. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Couple lines are open. You can send us an email if you'd like, talk@WPR.org, or our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, we'll be speaking with a gentleman who is an instructor of natural science at MATC, just returned from a three-week expedition to Antarctica, sponsored by the Geological Society of America, and the purpose of the trip was to study climate change. So that's coming up, hour two. Let's go, Craig, to an email first from Boyd, who wants to ask you about Sarah Palin. Now that she and Fox News have parted ways, for better or worse, have we heard the last of Sarah Palin?
Well, I haven't thought about Sarah Palin too much. And I think I'm not sure anything fundamental has changed with Sarah Palin. I mean, I think she sort of made the move from a, you know, a political figure to something else a while ago. And so I don't think anybody, well, I could be wrong because, you know, you got to be careful about making sweeping statements about the future, but there's not a lot of expectation in the political world that Sarah Palin will be a political player in the future. But what that means in terms of her, you know, her role in the media or anything else is anybody's guess.
Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Hello. To me, the big news was Senator Johnson of Wisconsin and his attempt to get some truth out of Secretary Hillary Clinton, who has lied continually. You know, she told one of the parents of the four people killed in Benghazi, she told them that they would arrest the maker of the video. And the very next day, that guy was arrested. The only man arrested for killing the four in Benghazi, the four Americans in Benghazi, was this video maker. Obama and Hillary talked about them for weeks because they didn't want to talk about continuing Arab terrorism, continuing Muslim fanatical terrorism, which goes on even in Algeria just last week, killing another American. The utter collapse of our foreign policy under Obama and Hillary. We are giving aid, financial and military aid, to Morsi, who calls the Jews the children of pigs and so forth. These are fanatical Muslims, and they've tried to paper that over and call them moderates.
What did you make of her testimony and Senator Johnson's questioning, Craig?
Well, you know, I'll sort of confine myself to Senator Johnson because that's, you know, kind of what I was focused on last week when that happened. And he did make kind of a splash. I mean, this was, you know, what's interesting about this is that he's new to the committee. I mean, he was on the Appropriations Committee in his first 2 years, which he's no longer on. He's on Foreign Relations, which is kind of an interesting move for him because that's not an area that he's associated with. He's been kind of uniformly and very single-mindedly focused on the issue of debt and deficit and spending, size of government. And here he is on Foreign Relations Committee in his first hearing, and in a very, you know, there's a very attention-getting exchange between him and Secretary of State Clinton, in which he's, I don't think he was rude. I think he was persistent about, you know, asking her, pursuing this line of questioning and this line of criticism, accusing U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice of intentionally misleading the public in how she talked about who the attackers were and what we knew about the attacks, and then, you know, pressing Secretary of State Clinton, why didn't you know more sooner? Why didn't you interview the evacuees? And toward the end of that questioning, Secretary of Clinton didn't exactly blow up, but her voice raised, and she kind of built to sort of a crescendo and talked about, you know, the impact of these deaths and what was going on in real time, and kind of pushed back against this criticism, and said at one point something to the effect of, you know, what difference does it make exactly who these people were at the time? We've got to find out. We've got to punish them and answer. And so that was one of the dramatic moments in the testimony. She testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House International Relations Committee. And Senator Johnson got a lot of attention. I think conservatives were very happy with the exchange because they thought that Hillary Clinton made a mistake in suggesting that the nature of the attack was irrelevant. On the other hand, Senator Johnson told reporters after the hearing that he thought Secretary of State Clinton had kind of manufactured her emotion in order to dodge the questioning, and he got some criticism for that. And so it was kind of a mixed bag for him.
And then Senator Kerry took him to task, is my understanding, for not attending Benghazi hearings. Is that true? Did he not do that?
Well, that issue's a little tangled. I mean, the one thing you have to remember there is that, like I said, he is new to the committee, and I'm not actually sure whether the hearings, which hearings, whether Senator Kerry was referring to hearings that were open to all senators or hearings that were open open to members of the committee, Senator Johnson, the committee which Senator Johnson just joined.
Thanks, Hugh, for the call. Scott in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Good morning. I wanted to kind of make a strange comparison between the gun debate and the tax debate that we just had recently. And Well, I'm a conservative who actually is for gun control. I think the assault rifles that are out there are ridiculous. I think the 300 million guns out there that are ridiculous, the high-capacity magazines. So I'm for 100% background checks. When it comes to taxation, I don't have an issue with higher marginal tax rates. But my point is we consume a lot of oxygen about things that really are irrelevant and won't do anything. The 500 murders that occur in Chicago where handguns are banned will continue after this little debate and discussion over gun laws, and they will continue because we're not addressing the societal issue. The taxes that are going up on the wealthy, great, wonderful, but at the same time, it's going to be irrelevant because it's going to generate about $60 billion a year when we have a $1.1 trillion deficit. Why is so much time, so much oxygen consumed, especially in the media and the press, regarding issues that really aren't going to help out? I'm just baffled by how much time is spent talking about gun control that won't affect the murders in Chicago or anywhere else in the United States, or raising taxes on the rich, which don't address the societal issue we have with the amount of debt.
Well, I think that's a very thoughtful question and a legitimate point. I mean, it's very fair to ask, on the gun front, what's the impact if we do some incremental things in terms of background checks or gun regulation? It's very fair to ask what's the impact of that in the end. It's very fair to ask the same question about, top marginal tax rates. I think one reason why these issues get so much attention is, they're issues that divide the parties. So they produce these very dramatic confrontations and battles, pitch battles between the parties. And two, they are issues that that have a lot of symbolic power for partisans, not just people in office, but voters too. I mean, in other words, you saw that, for the Republican Party has invested a lot in the notion of not just lowering and not raising marginal tax rates, but also in the notion of no tax increases ever. And so that's been a big stumbling block for them. And by the same token, Democrats, it's a big symbolic issue for Democrats that people at the top have to sort of pay more. Guns the same way. I mean, these are issues that stir up a lot of emotion, stir up a lot of passion, and also kind of go to some of the core values on both sides in terms of the two parties. But I think the caller's point is totally legitimate that you can really argue whether issues like that are really the most consequential issues and policy fights that we should be having right now.
Another thing that happened last week, and it all of a sudden there it was, I'm wondering why it was there all of a sudden, is that women now will be able to serve in combat. How did that happen? Why did that happen now?
Well, I think it's, I don't know why it happened now as opposed to a year from now, but I do think it's part of a continuum. I mean, you've seen, and it was widely reported and talked about at the time this change was announced, that in some ways the change has already occurred. I mean, that in reality women have been exposed to combat, they've been dying, and this has been, a kind of an evolution, and even going forward it's going to be a slow kind of evolutionary process because the military hasn't entirely determined exactly which combat roles are going to be open to women, and how soon. And so, again, I don't know why the announcement was made on the day it was made or the week or the month it was made, but I think it's part of a movement. And I'm not sure, the other interesting thing about it is, how controversial is this? I mean, compared to 5 or 10 years ago, if the announcement had been made then, I mean, there's certainly some. I was at this conservative conference over the weekend that the National Review magazine sponsored, and on one of the panels, somebody brought up this issue, which hadn't been getting much discussion. It was basically saying, this is a conservative activist was basically saying, how come there's not more outrage about this? Mm-hmm. We think it's terrible. And that was telling because it is interesting that it's not more controversial than it would have been in the past. I mean, like a lot of things, when it comes to issues like of gender, when same you can say the same thing about sexual orientation and gay rights, that you know the goalposts have been moved on these issues, and so we're in the middle of a lot of change.
What else was discussed at that National Review Conference, Craig?
Well, it was interesting to me because both Governor Walker and Paul Ryan were featured speakers there, and then there were just a lot of panels where party strategists and activists and commentators were just sort of discussing what happened in 2012 and how the party goes forward and how the conservative movement, not just the party, but more broadly the conservative movement goes forward. There was some interesting kind of soul-searching, I thought. I mean, there were people were raising questions about whether there's been too much sort of ideological conformity, enforced conformity in the party, and whether it's, you know, the conservative media has choked off debate within the party. There are questions about on the sort of mechanics and technology of campaigns and complaints about the Republican Party really falling behind Democrats in this last campaign when it comes to, you know, targeting voters, identifying voters, new media, just sort of sophisticated technology and again, the way campaigns are conducted. There was discussion about the Republican Party needing to do a much better job communicating with voters outside its traditional base. We talked about immigration and reaching out and doing a better job of talking to and seeking the votes of Latino voters and other voters of color, young voters. A lot of it, people were talking about single women, unmarried women as a huge demographic that Democrats won by a massive margin in this campaign, and what's going on there and what that means for the future. So there was it was an interesting event on a bunch of different levels, I think it's part of a running discussion that all parties have when they have a disappointing election. I mean, the Republicans, obviously huge disappointments at the presidential and Senate level in this race, and they're trying to figure out, you know, how much of their problem was tonal and stylistic and how much of it was organizational and mechanical and how much of it just had to do with candidates and how much of it had to do with substance.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering where, and let's talk about Governor Walker here for a moment, who still seems to be all over the national press. He has a huge national presence right now. He seems to be changing some of his rhetoric lately, talking about more money for education. It would appear that there is, as you just indicated, a moderation on certain kinds of issues, a change in what the focus is.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, I think it's probably smart politics. I think he's, having gone through this sort of searing and polarizing experience of Act 10 and the protests and the recalls, I think it's natural for him to want to let the dust settle, mm-hmm. and to be less of a lightning rod. And that, I think that involves kind of the way you talk about issues, whether it involves substantive changes or not. I mean, he'll have some interesting choices to make when it comes to ideas that are sort of bubbling up from the legislature. He'll be confronted with some really conservative proposals, and he'll have to decide whether he wants to encourage them or discourage them or sign them or not sign them. He's got, you know, he can afford, because these fights of the last 2 years made him a hero to the right, both in the state and nationally. Whenever that happens, it gives you some freedom of maneuver to moderate a little bit on some issues if you want to do that, or if you think you need to do that. And so he has a little bit of that freedom because he's got so much credibility among conservatives right now because of having gone through and having survived that fight. So if he wants to do that, he can probably do that.
Thank you, Scott, for your call. We go to Tom in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just wondering if your guest ever hears anything about George W. Bush. He just seems to have fallen off the face of the earth. And I'm just wondering if perhaps he's not well.
Well, interesting question, because we were just talking about this event, this conservative conference that I attended over the weekend, and his name did come up in some really interesting ways. And I think, you know, he's to sort of answer your question more directly, I mean, he's just been pretty assiduous about not being in the public eye and about not speaking out and about not being not drawing attention to himself. What's interesting to me is how, you know, is sort of his place in the party and what people think about him. And, you know, certainly for a lot of Republicans, there's kind of this feeling that he really damaged the Republican brand in his second term, and by spending a lot of money and doing some things to expand the entitlement state, you know, in terms of Medicare Part D. And so on the one hand, you've got sort of a sense among conservatives that that he damaged the conservative brand in an important way. But you've also got, I mean, the argument was also made at this conference by some people that, you know, here we are talking about the problems Republicans face in terms of reaching out to different kinds of voters and the problems with the Latino vote and the, maybe the failure of the party to do more to kind of aggressively speak to voter concerns about bread and butter issues like education and health care costs. And one speaker made the point where those were things that George W. Bush really tried to do as president and had some success doing. I mean, he's the only Republican in the last six presidential elections to win a majority of the popular vote, and he also, you know, did the best performance according to the exit polls of Latino voters of any president in recent times, and far better than Mitt Romney. So, I think you can have an interesting debate about George Bush in the context of whether the Republican Party and whether the conservative movement and how much he represented a kind of a move backward and how much he represented a move forward.
It is remarkable, though. We just haven't seen very much of him.
No. And I think, you know, the one number kind of explains that in a nutshell. When you look at the exit polls from November of 2012, I mean, it's just amazing that when people were asked, you know, who bears more responsibility for the mess we're in economically 4 years later, and more people said George W. Bush than Barack Obama. And what's amazing about that, whatever you think about the, you know, the answer to that question, it's just the fact that people continue, that many people continue to blame the president who left office 4 years earlier. That was a huge factor in this election. It tells you a lot about why, you know, he's been kind of on the shelf.
Right. Thank you, Tom, so much for your interesting call. We go to Mark in Oshkosh next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the speaker's the guest's comment on the recent proposals by most recently in Virginia to change how the Electoral College votes are distributed, going from winner-take-all to congressional districts. And by some analyses, the race between Romney and Obama would have come out quite differently under the proposed changes. And I just I'll take my comment off.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'm actually writing something about this today.
And you are.
I wrote a long piece about it a year ago or a year and a half ago because there was some discussion in Wisconsin about ending the winner-take-all rule for allocating electoral votes. It never really got anywhere, but it raises some really serious issues, and it's very dubious in a lot of levels. I mean, if you do that, whatever state you do it in, you're kind of taking, if you're doing it in a battleground state, you're kind of rendering that state irrelevant in a presidential campaign, because basically no presidential campaign is going to pour a lot of time and effort and resources into winning electoral votes congressional district by congressional district, as opposed to winner take all, especially when most of the congressional districts are not competitive. So those votes are kind of baked into the cake. You look at Wisconsin, eight congressional districts, none of them are particularly competitive. And so in a competitive race nationally, those congressional districts, you can assume they're votes for one party or the other, because they're not 50-50 districts. And so you have you kind of basically neutralize your role as a state in the presidential campaign. But two, it has a dramatic partisan impact. Basically it's true that if you had, depending on how many states you're talking about doing it in, but the key states here, we're talking about a handful of states that have been voting Democratic at the presidential level, like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, but are controlled by Republicans at the state level, so they have the ability to change the rules. And also, most of the congressional districts in these states, because of the way the districts are drawn, have a majority Republican vote. So you not only would not be giving all the electoral votes to the statewide winner, assuming it's a Democrat, but you'd be actually giving, in a lot of scenarios, the majority of the state's electoral votes to the loser of the statewide vote because of the way the districts are drawn. And in Virginia, it was a strange case because just sort of in a purely out of self-interest for the Republican Party, it was sort of, I questioned, you know, it's fallen through in Virginia, but it didn't make a lot of sense for Republicans to pursue this change in Virginia, because Virginia is a state that, even though Obama won it twice, Republicans can still compete in, and they need those votes in a close presidential election. It would be an unmitigated boon to Republicans to do this in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, because they've been losing those three states. It would be sort of a signal that they've given up on those states if they did it, because that's the only reason you do it, is to basically create this sort of electoral shift in your favor. I don't think it's going to happen, because I just think it would engender so much controversy, and it would also create a whole legitimacy debate about, you know, if you actually altered the outcome of a presidential election by changing the electoral rules in a few states, especially if it meant giving the majority of those states electoral votes to the person who lost that state. Think about what happened in 2000, and then multiply it by a factor of 3 or 4 in terms of the debate that would ensue after the election about the outcome, just based purely on the process.
Yeah. Craig Gilbert is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, the 28th of January, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number, a couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, our guest who recently returned from a remarkable expedition to Antarctica, sponsored by the Geological Society of America to study climate change, George Stone, who is an instructor of natural science at the Milwaukee Area Technical College, co-founder and chair of the Green Energy Summit in Milwaukee, will be our guest, second hour of our show. Two more phone calls, 800-486-8655 is the number. Mike and, no, it's Chris is next in Pulaski. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm actually calling on the gun debate, and a much simpler answer for me would be, rather than going after the guns which people already possess or the guns people own, wouldn't it be a much easier case to go after ammo change? In other words, changing to non-lethality, rubber bullets and so forth. And I'll take my answer off here.
I've heard this question raised in the past. I think I remember Senator Pat Moynihan, the late Senator Moynihan. I seem to remember him years and years ago suggesting kind of shifting the debate and regulating ammunition rather than guns. I don't know. I mean, from a policy standpoint, I don't know whether how realistic it is and what the impact is. I mean, there are people that would be in a better position to speak to that than me about how effective that would be. In terms of the politics, I'm not sure it would be any easier to do. Certainly, there are some things you could do, obviously, with ammo in terms of restricting, you know, like cop killer bullets and armor-piercing ammunition and that kind of thing. But in terms of, in a broad way, kind of, you know, limiting bullets per se, as opposed to rubber bullets, that might be a heavy lift.
Thanks, Chris. Jill in Wauwatosa. Hi. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I have a question regarding the Democrats, Senator Reid. Why in the world, even a small amount of filibuster reform did not get passed, and it seemed as though Reid rammed through this another handshake deal, which did virtually nothing to help the Senate to be able to function. And furthermore, he disciplined Democratic senators who attempted to talk about which Democratic senators may have needed some information from their constituents as to what constituents have wanted, because we worked like our butts off to make sure that what happened in the Senate wouldn't happen again, and we feel like the rug has just been pulled out from under us.
Well, the change that was made was pretty modest. I mean, I think everybody agrees on that, and it seemed like the reason it was modest was because, you know, for the same reason that we have a filibuster and the filibuster reform is really difficult, it's really hard to do things in the Senate, and it wasn't clear whether Democrats had the ability to, or supporters of filibuster reform had the ability to do something more dramatic without touching off a real process war in the Senate, which Reid didn't want to do. I mean, you can try to do things by a majority vote, and the risk is sort of, you know, people use the term nuclear, the nuclear option. It's called the nuclear option because the risk is just setting off kind of a wildfire within the institution because it's seen by the minority as imposing something on them. Even if it has a majority vote, they're used to controversial items having to reach this threshold of 60 votes, and that has been the system in the Senate. And so they took a real baby step toward changing that, because I don't think they had the ability to politically to change it in a more dramatic way. And then the other question, of course, is if you're in the majority one day, you know, you could easily find yourself in the minority the next day. And so I think people who've served in the Senate, especially more experienced senators, understand that, you know, they are going to be in the minority one day and they may want that power.
We haven't talked about Senator Harkin deciding that he was going to relinquish power and not run again. He is thought of, I'm sure, by people on both sides, even though he is a progressive man, as an honorable man.
Yeah, I think he's well-liked in the Senate, and he's been around for a long time. Remember, he ran for president in 1992,
yes,
the same year that Bill Clinton got elected. And I spent a little bit of time with him doing a profile of him in that campaign. And he's an interesting guy who just sort of came up from, you know, pulled himself up by his bootstraps and pretty humble, modest beginnings, and became kind of a progressive firebrand, hasn't been a big voice, you know, hasn't been a real attention-getting voice in the Senate in recent years, but Iowa's been one of those states where you had this interesting pair of senators. We have probably a more dramatic pairing in Wisconsin now with Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin.
We sure do.
But Iowa has had for years Tom Harkin and Charles Grassley, a pretty conservative Republican and a pretty liberal Democrat,
mm-hmm.
and in a battleground state that, you know, and now we're kind of, that sort of describes Wisconsin pretty well too. And so it'll be interesting to see, obviously, who succeeds Tom Harkin and whether and which way the state goes. It's certainly a state that's capable of electing a member of either party to the Senate.
Jill, thanks so much for your call. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. There's a high probability that this year we're going to have to confront Iran. So I have a two-part question. First, how do you think that's going to evolve? And second, how do you think the Obama administration has been handling the whole question?
Well, I don't know. It's not really for me to say how they've, you know, degrade them on how they've been handling Iran. I think people have to, you know, sort of decide, come to their own conclusions about the merits of the president's and the administration's performance when it comes to Iran. I guess I wouldn't be so sure that there will be a confrontation with Iran. I don't think it's anything that anybody looks forward to, whether you're a hardliner on Iran or not a hardliner on Iran. It's such, obviously, a hugely difficult issue, and obviously having the U.S. having intervened in Afghanistan and Iraq, there's not a lot of will, I don't think, in the military or in the political class to sort of take on in a major way a big military commitment involving Iran. So I guess I'd be more surprised than the caller if there were a major confrontation with Iran this year, but which isn't to say that there's going to be, I'm not saying it's not going to be a big issue, and I'm not saying there aren't going to be tensions and interesting developments on that front, but I guess I would be surprised if we ended up with a dramatic military confrontation with Iran in the short term.
Thanks, Mike. We go to Mark in Hixton. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I had a question about voter registration. Why don't we have like a fingerprint instead of a driver's license recognition? Fingerprint recognition as far as voter registration, everybody's got one. You don't have?
Right.
I've heard of other countries doing it.
What do you think about that, Craig?
Yeah, I haven't heard a lot of discussion about that, probably
no.
Because, you know, it's just obviously would involve a huge expense, and also there'd be a lot of issues about a lot of civil liberties concerns, a lot of privacy concerns. You have, you know, some of the people, a lot of the people who think that that the voting laws are too lax are on the conservative side. Yet there's also, I think there would also be big concerns on the conservative side about kind of the Big Brother aspects of requiring fingerprints of voters. So you don't hear a lot of talk about that.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. Bill in Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
All right. My comment, and actually a comment and opinion, is that I think after watching a month now of all these debates on gun control, gun changing, gun laws, I think we've got to start somewhere. And I'm sure, as a former NRA member and a good outdoorsman, a hunter, a sportsman, to go right off the bat with these so-called assault weapons, because that's exactly what they are. Those children in Connecticut were assaulted. People other parts of the country and around the world have been assaulted with those guns by civilians. These guns should not be in the hands of anybody, just for public use. They're not considered a sporting weapon. They're not considered a target weapon. They're exactly what they're dedicated to be, assault weapons. And we have to start somewhere. Watching TV yesterday, they were talking about, oh, we should try this gun, this gun, this gun. Maybe we should go to test the people. Maybe we should, control the amount of ammunition. I think, like we did with call it Obamacare, call it national health care, call it the people who need health care. We have to start somewhere and build on it or reduce it or change it, but we have to get something in place so we can work on it instead of just debating this for another 5 years.
Are you still a member of the NRA, Bill?
No, I was out years ago, but it had nothing to do with weapons so much as when, I've got the illustrious Charlton Heston got in there and became, in my mind, pretty much a caricature of the NRA instead of an upstanding actor and award winner. With that, pry my hands from my cold dead hands from my weapon thing. I thought, that's a little bit over dramatic there for somebody who's trying to play Moses and everybody else. Yeah. And it was just, there's no need for that. The NRA has too much power and is filling too many pockets of too many senators and congressmen. And I think it's just time we have to kind of take charge of our own selves and say, look, we got to start banning something and build on it from there.
Craig.
Well, I think there are people that feel that way, and that's why we're having this big debate. And the NRA is obviously a lightning rod in a lot of ways. By the way, the president of the NRA is from Wisconsin, David Keene, who's a longtime conservative activist in Washington. And there's a lot of people at the NRA nationally who have ties to Wisconsin. But that's just an aside. The assault weapon issue is a tough issue because a lot of it boils down to how do you define an assault weapon and how you differentiate an assault weapon from any semi-automatic weapon. And that's kind of where the original assault weapon ban kind of foundered, the one that was passed in 1994 and then lapsed after 10 years. Interestingly, Russ Feingold, the progressive senator from Wisconsin who was defeated in 2010, opposed the renewal of the assault weapon ban for that reason, because he argued, like a lot of critics of the assault weapon ban, that the difference between a weapon that was captured by the assault weapon ban and a weapon that wasn't was really cosmetic. I mean, they had to come up with definitions like if it has certain features like a bayonet plug or a handle, it was an assault weapon, and if it didn't, it wasn't. And whether that really spoke to the to the power of the weapon to kill people wasn't at all clear. So there are some serious issues when it comes to how to legislate an assault weapon ban, and again, politically, I think that it's going to be tough to do that. But I do think, what's difficult again about this issue is I do think there's a lot of public sentiment for doing something. And
yes,
the question is what that something is and whether it's something that has symbolic value or whether it's something that arguably will have a real impact or not. Those are the tough things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Bill, for your call. Craig, a great pleasure to speak with you, and thank you.
Anytime.
All right. We'll call you again, sir.
Okay.
Craig Gilbert, our guest, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There is a lot going on this week and last week, and we're probably going to be talking more about immigration because the president's speech is tomorrow and the bipartisan group of Democrats and Republicans announcing a plan today. So that should be on our agenda for one of our hours tomorrow. Thanks to Craig Gilbert for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, doing on-air production as well, and for all of your calls and interest in what's going on in this country politically. Thank you very much. News is coming up in a moment. We'll return for another hour.